The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, is that good? So in thinking about what to reflect on this evening, my mind kind of just went all over the place, and I kind of kept coming back to this one thread as it was wandering. It kept coming back to this thread around relationship and how, I guess partly because of the time of year, many of us are going to be, in family situations or other kinds of relational situations. And, often we think about our practice, our mindfulness practice, as being kind of internal. But actually the teachings that the Buddha offered include a lot around being in relationship, how to connect, how to be in relationship with this practice. And so I thought I'd just reflect a little bit on that and then see what's up for you around this topic at this time of year. There's one kind of famous sutta, a kind of an analogy or a parable, a teaching parable the Buddha offers around this topic of relationship. And it's a story of two acrobats who are, it's a master acrobat and his apprentice, and they're practicing together, and they use this, it's a kind of a dangerous situation, these acrobats. There's a bamboo pole that one of them holds up, and the other one climbs on the bamboo pole and does tricks up at the top of the bamboo pole. And the master, in giving instructions to the apprentice, says, "You watch out for me, and I'll watch out for you. And that way we'll be safe." And the apprentice says, "It feels like I need to watch out for myself, and you need to watch out for yourself. And that way we'll be safe." And the Buddha, in reflecting on this, after he tells this story, he says, he basically affirms that they're both necessary. They're both supportive. He affirms that the apprentice acrobat is right in that taking care of oneself is a taking care of others. And he also affirms that what the master says, taking care of others, is taking care of ourselves. And so this is a very relational teaching, and it's interesting to me to reflect on the situation. It's a situation of some danger in this case. There's some possibility of harm coming to one or both of them if they're not caring for each other. They're not caring for themselves if they're not caring for the other. And so this is a kind of thinking about this in terms of our relationships with each other. If we're not caring for each other, danger can happen. We can end up being harming others, harming ourselves through not taking this care. And so to me, it's a really interesting reflection to think about what are the kinds of ways that we take care of ourselves, and how does that support taking care of others, and how do we take care of others, and how does that support taking care of ourselves? So taking care, the Buddha said in that sutta, he said, how do we take care of ourselves? We take care of ourselves with mindfulness. By being mindful, we are taking care of our own hearts and minds. And this points to how, kind of a mindfulness as a protection, that if we are not mindful, our habits of mind are kind of choosing what happens for us when we're not aware of what's going on in our minds, when we're not aware of the choices that are being made. They're tending to be being made based on our conditioning, and often that conditioning has a lot of greed, aversion, and delusion in it. That greed, aversion, and delusion You know, when we start to look at that with mindfulness, and this is just going to be really brief, you know, when we look at greed, aversion, and delusion with mindfulness, we feel, we recognize actually that it is not, it's not well-being. It's an experience of suffering when we are caught in greed, aversion, or delusion. When we're caught by the idea of, I don't like this, I want to get rid of something, or I got to hold on to something, there's inherently a kind of a tension or a contraction in our system that is, in this moment, kind of giving away or giving over our happiness in this moment to some point in the future where maybe at some point in the future I'll get rid of that thing, or at some point in the future I'll get that thing. Or there's a sense of like the, maybe there's a little bit of, in having something, some kind of fear about losing it in this moment. And so we're essentially in the experience of greed, aversion, and delusion. We are in the moment struggling, but we're often not aware of it. When we're not mindful, we are thinking that it's serving us in some way. You know, it's going to make me happy in the future when I get that thing. That's a good thing. But we're kind of not aware that it's in the moment of the wanting or in the moment of the aversion, there's a contraction and a pain internally. And so that is a way of protecting ourselves when we become aware with mindfulness. I mean, what the first thing that happens is we become aware of that discomfort, that feeling of the discomfort. But the way this whole process works is that as we become aware of that discomfort with mindfulness, our system, our human organism, it's actually a great thing, our human organism, because it wants to move in the direction of well-being. It wants to be happy in a way, only it's kind of really been confused about how it a deeper or more reliable or a more lasting kind of happiness is possible. And so it's been content for years, or not necessarily content, but basically believing that getting something that I want, getting rid of something that I don't want, this is about as good as it gets in terms of happiness. And so the mind is kind of hooked into that habit or pattern. But as soon as we start to see it with mindfulness, see those habits and patterns with mindfulness, our system, our human system, begins to recognize that this is not well-being in the present moment. And our human system begins to slowly over time kind of figure out how to change the program, change the direction, let go of that habit, let go of those tendencies. And so it's a gradual process of change. And yet the mindfulness kind of protects us in that moment. So it's a protection in the moment for ourselves, in that we're not kind of continuing to reinforce and reinforce that greed, aversion, or delusion in the moment. It's kind of like, you know, if we're driving a car down the road at a pretty good speed at 60 miles an hour, we got our foot on the accelerator, that momentum of that car is just going, and we're adding to the momentum. It's continuing to go. And when we are not aware of greed, aversion, and delusion, it's kind of like we have our foot on the accelerator of those habits and patterns. We are reinforcing them. We've got our car in gear, and we are heading in that direction, following that habit of greed, or that habit of aversion, or that habit of delusion. The mindfulness kind of serves to do something akin to putting the car into a neutral gear. You know, that when we put the car into neutral and we're going 60 miles an hour, it doesn't come to a stop immediately, but it does kind of give us some space to, you know, it will come to a stop. We can kind of steer it safely, hopefully, until it comes to a stop. And putting, having mindfulness of those habits and patterns is kind of like that. It puts our minds into neutral so that we're not fueling or feeding those habits and patterns. We're not wearing that groove more. And we can hopefully hold the pattern in a way, in a skillful way, so that we're not automatically acting on it. This is where the danger for others comes in. So these patterns of greed, aversion, and delusion are a danger for ourselves in that they cause suffering for ourselves in the moment. We see that. They're a danger for ourselves in that if we're just acting on them blindly without being aware that they're happening, they're tending to head us in the direction of that pattern happening more. This is the natural way that conditioning works. The Buddha said that whatever we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of our minds. If we frequently ponder hatred and anger and greed, that becomes the inclination of our minds. And so that suffering that we experience, that the pain of that, just becomes more and more. The dissatisfying nature of wanting to get something, the happiness of that not lasting that long, and then all we know is, well, the last time I was happy when I got something, so maybe I should want something. So we just end up on this cycle of the same habits and patterns just carrying us along. And it's painful, actually. And with mindfulness, we start to experience that. We recognize the painful quality, the painful nature of these habits of mind. But they're not only painful internally. This is kind of what we look at when we meditate. You know, we turn our attention in meditation to what's arising in our minds. And we see, you know, oh, there's anger in there. And it was kind of a shock to me, actually, when I first really felt this anger is, wow, that hurts. Because when I was caught in the story of the anger, it was telling me that, yeah, this anger is going to make the other person miserable. You know, it's going to get back at them. And that's what my mind was caught in, that story, and completely missing that the anger was hurting me here. And so this is what we do in the mindfulness practice. We begin to understand how these habits of mind are harmful to us, hurt us. And so this is how mindfulness is a kind of a protection for ourselves, by protecting ourselves. With mindfulness, we protect ourselves. We begin to understand that these are not useful habits of mind. And the mind begins to understand how to let go of them. It is much less inclined to pick them up and to follow them as it understands that way lies suffering. That way is going to be a struggle here in this system. But the other piece of this, and this is how in the teaching of the acrobats, where the Buddha said, protecting ourselves, we protect others, because those habits and patterns of mind are not just felt internally. When we're motivated, or when greed, aversion, and delusion are happening in our minds and we're not mindful of them, we tend to just kind of follow them. We act on them. And we put actions based on greed, aversion, and delusion into the world. And actions based on greed, aversion in the world, well, they can have, you know, those kinds of actions tend to be less concerned about the welfare of others. They're more concerned about what's going to be good for me, even though as we're doing it, it's already painful internally. But those states of mind are so confused that they think it's doing something good for ourselves, but they're not so concerned about what's happening for others often. And so this, as we begin to be aware of these states internally, we also begin to recognize how they affect people externally. We see that acting out of anger, you know, we know this actually. It's like we certainly know it if somebody comes at us with anger. You know, if somebody is angry at us, what often happens? We kind of, it's like we become angry and back. So it's not only that in our own system does the anger tend to increase the rut of more anger, like we've got our foot on the gas pedal, our own car, But it's like we put our foot on the gas pedal of our own car, and it's putting that out into the world, and then other people do the same thing. So not only does what we think and ponder become the inclination of our own minds, but it puts that into the world, and it's kind of contagious. Our mind states are contagious, you know, and I think we see this so much happening right now, how much the divisiveness is fueling more divisiveness in our country right now. And so those patterns of mind, if we are not aware of them, we are just contributing to the conditioning in the world. So the way conditioning works is not just in our own system. You know, it's like, yes, when I'm acting on greed, aversion, and delusion in here, it is conditioning greed and aversion and delusion in my own heart and mind, but it also puts it into the world. We affect each other. How we are influences each other. And so this is a way that if we are aware of these habits and patterns, greed, aversion, and delusion in our own hearts and minds, it can create some space with mindfulness. It can create some space, maybe not so that it goes poof and goes away immediately, but at least perhaps so that we have some sense of care and caution. Maybe we won't automatically act on them. Maybe we won't put actions into the world based on those states of mind. And that would be a good thing. And so this is one of the ways in which this relational piece, this relational field happens. That how we are affects not only ourselves, but it affects the world. And then the other side, protecting others, one protects oneself. And this one, the Buddha said, the practice of loving kindness is a protection for others. They're just being kind to others. And in a way, this is definitely the flip side of not acting on greed, aversion, and delusion. Instead, putting the other side of the equation into the world. Maybe we don't always feel kind, but maybe we can act with kindness, act out of care, out of concern, out of generosity and compassion. That kind of concern for others, and acting out of the compassion, the care, the concern, also is connected to non-harming. You know, not engaging in actions that would harm others, out of care and concern for others. Not to do things that would create harm. So these are aspects of that kindness, basically, being kind to others, to care for others, to not do things that would create pain in the world. And so by protecting others, I mean, the Buddha said protecting others. So by protecting others through our care about our ethical conduct, how we are not harming, through care through others, through generosity and supporting them when they need help, care for others in kindness and compassion if they're suffering, to aid and support them. Through that, the Buddha says, we also take care of ourselves. And so again, this reciprocal nature of relationship. So how does that work? I mean, when we take care of others, one of the kind of obvious ways where taking care of others, we take care of ourselves, is that if we are committed to non-harming, if we're committed to ethical conduct, then we get the rebound of that on our own minds is that we have ease of mind that others are not don't have to be afraid in our presence. There's a kind of a sense of we don't have to have remorse. Our minds are protected from remorse because we are committed to this non-harming. And so this this kind of back and forth reciprocal nature of caring for ourselves, we care for others, caring for others, we care for ourselves. I just finished teaching a retreat with Gil, and we started the retreat with a quote, kind of a something that Gil had found that we both found inspiring. I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget it. And it's a connection here. This is a piece that's kind of connecting both how kind of how our practice, our own kind of care and wisdom for ourselves and how that affects others. It says, one who is wise, and so wisdom in the Buddha's teaching is basically this wisdom associated with what takes us away from suffering, what leads us towards a deeper kind of happiness. And it's very much this understanding greed, aversion, and delusion takes us in the direction of suffering. This is one of the key definitions of wisdom that the Buddha points to, is that we need to understand those states of mind that keep us caught in suffering. And those states based in greed, aversion, and delusion tend to keep us digging those ruts. And the other side is states based in non-greed, non-aversion, non-aversion, non-delusion. Those lead us away from suffering. So this is one of the key definitions of wisdom. One who is wise understands this. And so it says, one who is wise is concerned for the welfare of self, the welfare of others, the welfare of both, and the whole world. And so to me, this is a beautiful kind of connection of wisdom and love in the Buddhist teachings. It starts with wisdom, that a wise person, and this is, again, one who has, in this case, this is a statement of someone who is wise, so someone who does understand this difference, someone who does understand what leads towards suffering and what leads away from suffering. And that person who understands that is very naturally concerned for the welfare of themselves and others, the welfare of the whole world. To me, this is a beautiful reflection. You know, that actually the more we practice, the more we free our own hearts and minds from these patterns of struggle, we benefit from that. We see that in the meditation, you know, when we sit down. There's moments in the meditation when we see something let go. We see a pattern or a habit. For myself, around, you know, anger, it was such a big, big part of my life. And I didn't quite see, you know, how it would be possible to be free from it. But there was a moment, one moment early in my practice when watching anger in my mind and seeing how the anger created so much pain internally. At one point, the mind kind of watched itself start to pick up an anger at a particular person. There was a thought that came into the mind about the person I was angry with, and the whole kind of inclination of the mind was to jump on that thought and think more thoughts to get angry at the person. But having spent so much time seeing and feeling and experiencing the suffering personally here of that anger, the mind just said, I don't think so. And it just let it go. And so that was the kind of a real pointing to the way the mindfulness protects us. You know, that it is a protection for oneself to be mindful. So this concern for self, you know, the more that we are, that when we are concerned for ourselves and we feel that kind of release from that suffering, it not only affects us, though. And actually, not long after that, there was another kind of recognition, kind of very similarly in a way, you know, seeing a thought arise in my mind and recognizing how, you know, there was pain associated with the anger in the mind and the kind of like the wish in a way that person that I was angry with hurt in some way. That was another shock around anger, was seeing how that mind of anger wanted the other person to suffer. And in that recognition, you know, aware of that mind that wanted the other person to hurt, there was an immediate kind of opening. And you know, I don't know how this happens, but it seems to be that when we are mindful, our minds not only understand something about ourselves, but it kind of extrapolates. And in seeing that, my mind understood, wow, this is happening in my own mind. This wish for somebody else to be miserable, to suffer because of something they did to me. And in the extrapolation, it's kind of like my mind just kind of multiplied that by 6 billion. You know, that kind of mind, that kind of attitude of mind. And it was like, in that moment, it's like, no wonder there's war. No wonder there's so much suffering in the world. And so that, again, was a real kind of opening or lesson about how this, what's happening here in this mind ripples out into the world and affects others. And so the heart does begin to kind of crack open with care and concern, not only for ourselves, but for others. And then very naturally, we have this movement that is expressed in that sutta about the acrobats, that we care for others. We express it through kindness and concern and non-harming. And we care for ourselves. And it's not separate, actually. You know, that was another kind of learning for me. I thought that if I was taking care of somebody else, it meant I wasn't taking care of myself. But this exploration, this kind of teaching is a simultaneous caring for ourselves and caring for others, caring for both, caring for the world. So those are my reflections. What kinds of thoughts or reflections does this bring up for you, or anything? You know, just I'm curious what's up for you guys in this moment. Comments or questions or reflections?
So greed is wanting something for yourself, but if you wish well for somebody else, that's okay? How is that different from greed?
So that's a great question. What's the difference? You know, wanting, we think of greed as being a kind of a wanting. And what's the difference between a wanting of, you know, a kind of a wanting of something for me versus a wanting of happiness for the world? What's the difference there? And I think it comes back to where the greed piece. Well, first I'll say that often we might think that if we didn't have some kind of greed, why would we do anything? Or some kind of aversion? You know, it's like why would we do anything? And that is a Partly that's conditioned based on the way that we've lived to this point. It's like most of our motivation to do things has had a thread of greed, of something, wanting something for myself, or a thread of aversion, of like not wanting something. And so we feel like, you know, the belief embedded in greed and aversion is that that's how things work in the world. But there's another form of wanting that we could say, and it's more about the motivation. You know, it's kind of like the motivation of what is it, the motivation for this desire? Greed has a motivation of wanting something for me, kind of a separation of self and other, you know, a lack of concern for others, more concern for myself. It's a kind of also got a thread of kind of like neediness or stickiness. It's not going to be okay unless I have this thing. So there's a real kind of sticky quality to greed, that one of the words is craving. One of the Pali words, tanha, craving. It literally means thirst, where there's the sense that if I don't get that thing, it's like I'm going to die. It's got that quality to it. It's a real neediness. It's like if I don't get that thing, you know, it's going to be a real disaster. So that's the quality of greed. It's got a real stickiness to it. It's not okay if it doesn't get the thing. There's other kinds of desires, a wish, for instance, for the well-being of ourselves and others. This kind of wish doesn't have to have that kind of stickiness of neediness, of needing to have something happen. It's looking at that quality of the stickiness, and to some extent, a feeling in the heart. You know, the feeling connected with greed, I would say, has a constricted quality to it. Not okay if I don't get it, gotta hold on to it, a little bit of fear about losing it. So it's got kind of those flavors to it. There's a constricted quality when greed is present. There's another kind of wish or desire where the heart doesn't have that constricted quality. It's more like a feeling of open-heartedness. May you be happy. May you have ease in your life. And so there's a kind of movement of wanting something to happen, or movement in the direction of something happening, that isn't based on a constricted quality of heart, but is based on a more open-hearted quality. That open-hearted quality tends to be much more flexible. It's more, it's not so rigid about the outcome. It's more a sense of, okay, this direction. And the direction of the open heart kind of guides us. It's a feeling of this direction, and feels like the direction towards well-being. And so there's a quality in the Buddhist teaching called intention, or even just desire. Like chanda is the Pali word that is the kind of the quality that motivates action. And so there's a quality that will motivate our action, this desire, this wish. And that chanda, that wish to act, can be motivated out of greed, aversion, delusion, fear, confusion, or it can be motivated out of compassion and kindness, wisdom, generosity, love, care, concern. And that's a different quality in the heart than greed is. And so for me, actually, it really comes almost down to the feeling in this area of the heart. When I'm acting, does it feel constricted or tight, or does it feel open and connected? That's kind of the feeling to trust, is more that open-hearted kind of quality. So yes, there's definitely desires to act, and you know the wish to free our minds from suffering. That's a wish, and there's going to be mixed motivations. You know, it's rarely just one thing. You know, in wishing for the well-being and happiness of our family, there's some degree of love in there, of the quality of metta, of connectedness, of care and concern. But there's also probably some fear in there and some confusion and some stickiness. And it's not okay if my house burns down. You know, that's not okay. You know, so there's a mixture in there. You know, it's like, no, I don't want my house to burn down because I'd like my family to be safe. But there's also this kind of sticky quality too. And so some of what we explore in our practice is kind of teasing apart the sticky quality or the constricted quality of our desires from the movement of heart that wants to act or is motivated by the more wholesome qualities of mind, of love, of compassion, of care. It's like there's those qualities in the heart and mind also act, also influence the world. And so, you know, I was talking about being motivated by greed, aversion, and delusion, that it's contagious, that we are not only reinforcing the groove in our own minds, but we are kind of putting that out into the world. Well, likewise on the other side, with love and compassion and generosity, acting out of those qualities, they're motivated too. I mean, they motivate action. They also are contagious. So when we act out of those qualities, it tends to put more of that into the world also. I hope that's... Yeah, thank you. How do you define delusion? Yeah, that's a good question. I'll try to do this in a simple enough way. I would do whole like hour long talks on delusion. What I would say is, I mean, again, it's delusion around what causes suffering. So it's connected to that. It's not just simply like not knowing some information. You know, that's some kinds of knowledge we might not have about how to drive a car or how to, you know, bake a cake or something. That's not delusion. The delusion in this situation is delusion around what creates suffering. And you know, that we could kind of talk, there's different levels perhaps, and one of the most obvious ways that delusion plays out is when we're not aware. You know, when our minds are lost in thought, we're not present in the present moment. It's kind of like we're disconnected. We're not available to really be here in the present moment. There's delusion happening there. You know, it's almost like the delusion of non-awareness. So that's one form. That's probably the most obvious form. And we all experience that when our minds get lost. We wake up, we notice that we've been lost in thought. So, you know, that's one flavor. But the more insidious flavors are related to what I would call views. You know, we all believe certain things. We've been conditioned through our families, our cultures, our conditioning to have certain views and beliefs, and these views and beliefs are rarely questioned. They may not even be conscious. These views and beliefs may not even be conscious, and so we're acting out of those views and beliefs as if it was truth. But maybe it's simply a perspective. And so this is a form of delusion that we're not seeing that a view is operating, that we're just assuming to be truth. We're like, when we have those views and beliefs, we are like kind of acting as if they were true, We are receiving information through that belief, confirming often, this is a well-known a psychological process now called confirmation bias. Based on a view, our minds tend to take in information that confirms a view and not take in information that disconfirms the view. So that there's the, that's a form of delusion, that the mind is actively based on a view that has been conditioned, that, different, cultures come in with different conditioning. This culture has this view, this culture has this view. I mean, this is playing out right now in political parties, people taking in the perspectives based on the views they have and just kind of reinforcing what they already believe, actively not taking in the information on the other side. So this is a form of delusion, that we're not aware that a view is operating. So that form of delusion can operate at what we could call more a social or a psychological level, our personal conditioning, the conditioning of our culture, the conditioning around that we have around race, around gender, around age, around sexual orientation, so many isms that come out that, people have views about what people are capable of, and they're just beliefs, they're just views, and yet that tends to reinforce whole systems, like organizations can be set up based on those views, and it tends to reinforce and confirm those views. So this is the area of views, and it may not feel like it's like either like greed or aversion. It's just what feels like is true. And so this is pretty insidious, actually, that we are unaware of so many of these kinds of views operating. We can begin to become aware that views are operating when we run into people who don't believe those views, or we end up in a situation where a particular view is challenged, even non-verbally. I mean, sometimes, like in a kind of a more neutral place where views operate, perhaps, we all learn in our own culture what to do when we meet somebody that we've never met before, how far you stand away from them, how much eye contact you meet, whether you touch them or not. There's just all kinds of like cues that we have learned, but nobody sat down and said, this is what you do. It's not even a verbal thing. It's like it's felt, it's communicated through watching it happen. And if you go to another culture, you might feel a little discomfort when you meet somebody new and they behave differently. It's like, whoa, that feels uncomfortable. And so sometimes when we feel that a little bit of stress or discomfort around situations, that can be a sign that a view is being challenged. So that's a place or a way that we can have maybe a little bit of a doorway into seeing, oh, there's a view at work here. So there's that whole realm of psychological and societal, perhaps, views that operate, and the unawareness that they're operating is really, that's really where the danger lies. There's a study that looked at this kind of the kind of way in which a perspective, and it can be as simple as an agenda. We don't even have to have a deeply conditioned like view from the time we were children. It can be in a study, an agenda for performing a particular task. So there was a kind of a famous study around having people come and watch a video. And they were asked to count the number of times a basketball passed between players in white t-shirts. And there were, players in a different color t-shirt and a white t-shirt. And so you had to kind of track. It was a pretty tension-strong agenda. You had to really track where the basketball was when it passed from a white shirt to a white shirt. If it passed from a white shirt to a blue shirt, you didn't count it. So it's kind of a very strong attentional kind of thing. And so people did this task, and largely they could do it. At the end of the video, they could give the number, and mostly they were right. And a few people kind of thought back on the video, and it's like, was there like a guy in a gorilla suit in the video? And there had been somebody who had walked through and like stood in the middle of the field of the players passing the basketball, danced around for a little while, this guy in a gorilla suit, and then walked off. Most people had not seen the gorilla. So this is the way that, you know, attention works. You know, if we are focused on one thing, we have an agenda, we have a view, a perspective, we do not see certain things. And that's caution for us to be aware. We are not seeing things as they are. You know, we are not taking in information as if we're cameras. You know, we are taking in information very dynamically. The piece about this study that was a little more cautionary for me, I read that when they played the video back, you know, it's like most of the people didn't see the gorilla, and they played the video back, some number of people who hadn't seen the gorilla, so I think it was like 20-25% of the people who hadn't seen the gorilla said, "You played a different video." They didn't believe that they wouldn't have seen the gorilla. Now that's delusion, right? Now that's the scary part of delusion, is that willingness to, or that kind of certainty that I would have seen everything. So that's a kind of a more human kind of delusion. There's the third level of delusion, really, is the kinds of delusions we all share. You know, we have different kinds of views in cultural, in our personal or psychological conditioning, our societal conditioning, our cultural conditioning. We all have different kinds of views. But the Buddha pointed to, at a deeper level, just being human, there are some views that we share that are misperceptions, misunderstandings, that are delusional. We tend to take what is impermanent to be permanent. We tend to take what is unreliable to be reliable. We tend to take what's not self to be self. And those are kind of shot through how we relate to the world. You know, they actually motivate those views. They're taking something that's impermanent to be permanent and what's unreliable to be reliable is what motivates greed and aversion in the first place. You know, the idea that getting this thing is going to make me happy. It will be reliable. It will be something that lasts. So the belief around reliability at the deeper level is kind of part of how and why the greed and aversion get going in the first place. And so greed and aversion essentially are shot through with delusion. And we can think about, like, you know, this is a place to explore delusion. One real interesting, in any of the levels that we've talked about where we're talking about views, when there's suffering happening, some kind of belief or view will be at work, whether at the human level of taking something to be permanent and reliable or sense of self, or at the psychological or sociological level. And so when there is suffering, when we are experiencing suffering, there may be the kind of obvious suffering around, oh, I didn't get what I wanted. But there's also a belief at work there. And sometimes we can be curious about what is the belief at work here? And I actually use this question in my meditation when I'm kind of stuck in something or a little bit like struggling with something. It's like, well, what's being believed? And it doesn't always appear. And it's not always something that comes up into verbalization in the mind, but sometimes there's a little bit of an understanding of a perspective that's being held. So that's really a way to begin to get at delusion in the moment, in our practice, is to be curious about what the beliefs are. You know, there are beliefs embedded in aversion and delusion. You know, the belief in aversion, I mean, the aversion itself is the kind of the wish to separate, you know, the kind of sense of, don't like that, you know, want to get rid of it. The delusion embedded in aversion is, I'll be happy if I get rid of that. And likewise on the other side with greed, the delusion embedded in greed is, I'll be happy if I can keep that or have that thing. And there's a belief that that happiness is going to be lasting or somehow satisfying. So that those are the kind of delusions that are embedded in there. Now, so sometimes the delusions when we or the views when we kind of check in, what's being believed here? You know, it can be kind of inarticulate. You know, it can kind of just be like, blah. You know, just kind of a sense of bad. That's bad. You know, it's just a kind of a sense of something being wrong, or I'm bad, or I'm wrong, and so sometimes it's not very articulate, but you know, we might be able to touch into it. And sometimes when those beliefs are seen, you know, sometimes they're just so obviously not what we consciously believe. You know, that they're just a really deep kind of conditioned thing. But sometimes when we see them and recognize, wow, yeah, no, that I don't believe that consciously. But at the same time, what I encourage people to do is not to try to convince yourself not to believe it, because it's kind of a deep conditioned thing. So it's more like, oh, that's what's being believed. It's like, let it just come into awareness. Sometimes it can be seen as a useless kind of belief, and it might let go. But sometimes it's so deeply conditioned that all we can do is just go, "Yeah, that's being believed," and at least I know now that it's being believed, as opposed to just taking it as truth. So that's most of the time now. So, and does that?
I think I'm getting two things out of what I usually call self-deception.
We'll pass the mic forward.
What I termed for myself self-deception, you termed it as delusion. In the range of possibilities, there is the very serious version of delusion. That's what we're seeing in our president, I'm sorry to say. But I mean, in terms of even the mild ones, self-deception is a form of a delusion.
Yes, yes. When we're not seeing what's motivating us, when we're not seeing what's, you know, what beliefs are actually there.
Right, yeah. Right. There was another thing that I noticed, but I'm not going to say anything about it right now. Thank you.
So it's time to stop, so... Thank you for your questions.